Hi, welcome to Street Psychology. Today's guest is Ashley Cutler. She's going to talk about the cost of being the strong one or the go-to person, particularly as a Black woman. Common themes she likes to focus on is the Black women's mental health trauma and hyper-independence. Welcome. So yeah, let's talk about that. The cost of being the strong one. What does that mean and how does that resonate with your personal life?
Yeah, I think most Black women can identify with that mantra, be strong, and something mentioning strength somewhere along the lines, especially when you're talking about navigating very difficult situations. And so that actually is very invalidating. And I was talking with one person about that this week, is that what it does is it validates, right, that we are not carrying everything and we do not need to carry everything. And it actually does a lot of harm to our community, but does a lot of harm to Black women, right? Increasing the rates of certain things that we see, certain diseases, things that take us out of here, it's because we're trying to carry so much on our shoulders and we're in this chronic stress state.
So this chronic stress state, and it's because we're expected to be so strong. We're expected not to have problems, not to have mental health concerns of our own. Is that what you're saying? We're supposed to carry it?
Yeah, we carry it. And it's also the expectations of others, but we internalize this expectation, right? We encourage each other in that way. And sometimes we bond over the fact that we're all tired. I've definitely found myself in complaining times with other Black women where we're all just talking about how exhausted we are and how tired we are. And then that being the end of the conversation and that really bothering me, because we didn't come out of this with any solutions. We left this situation the same way we were when we came, which is exhausted and tired. And it's not just a physical, it's a embodiment. It's bigger than just I'm feeling physically tired. No, it's the mental, the emotional. And part of the reason I highlight the hyper-independence is because that's a common trauma response I'm seeing in Black women. So I'm a mental health therapist licensed in the state of Maryland and also a spiritual coach. And I see that a lot of this hyper-independence, it is responses to, I can only be the one to do this. This is my responsibility. And it snowballs then into putting us in unhealthy spaces.
Do you see that a lot with your clients?
Yeah, I see that a lot in general with Black women, right? Is that sometimes we don't know how to take our hands off of things. And what it can do is sometimes block us from having people in our life who actually can help us. People that actually can handle the delegation, right? And so we say, nobody's helping me, but we also are in a place where we don't know how to seek the help, right? How to receive it when it's actually there, and we'll keep people in our circle that are going to need us in a certain way. We'll keep the people that see us as the go-to. We'll keep showing up as the reliable one instead of saying, no, these relationships, I need to step away from these and actually go with the people that are going to give me reciprocity. Then you end up finding yourself in a self-fulfilling prophecy, the space that is unhealthy for you, you stay in because it's familiar.
Yeah, because it's familiar.
Because you know, right? Because you've been the go-to person, because you have been carrying everybody's stuff. You are the one that says, what does everyone else need?
Yeah. How much is learned? Why would we, as people, feel like that? Why would we keep ourselves in a situation that keeps us down? And we know it keeps us down. Why would we stay there instead of going out and doing something? What is pulling us back to that familiar place?
Yeah. Sometimes it is because we know other people are that are in that position. Like I said, I would leave those conversations really bothered because I would be like, nobody's talking about solutions. Nobody's talking about how do we shift from this, right? So I think there's a bonding around these experiences that calls us to say, this is how life is going to be. We throw our hands up and say, this is my plight. We cry about it, but then we don't get anywhere with it, right? We just are continuing in that cycle. And I do think learned behavior is a big part of it. What does society tell us, but also what are we hearing from our mothers, right? a lot of us have seen that hyper-independence in our mothers, constantly on the go, not resting, not taking care of themselves in a good way. And so those are things that you're going to naturally learn and pick up, and you're going to say, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. And then also the other thing is sometimes our family puts us in that position and they say, no, you are supposed to do these things for everyone. You are the smart one. You are the one that's successful. You are the one that has high achievement. So people can actually push us into this role, and we have to know that it's happening. So learned behavior can happen both ways, where you get the idea, this is who I'm supposed to be, the helper, and your identity starts to get connected in that.
What kind of strategies have you found work best to get out of that mindset?
Yeah, definitely mindset shifts and having to unlearn and relearn some things. One of those shifts is the idea that I don't need anyone, right? That notion really keeps us in that hyper-independent state. No, I do have needs. I cannot do it all. I sometimes need to take my hands out of things and not volunteer myself, especially if I know it's going to put me in a difficult position. So looking at and saying, what is my part? How can I step back and evaluate how I am engaging with people, recognizing, having that self-awareness of when I feel like I'm the only person that can do this. And that's an alarm for me to take a step back and say, why do you think this? Why do you think that you're the only one that can do this? And then saying, they can figure it out, right? Faith is another big part of it, just because when you believe in something greater than yourself, you can let go and take your hands off of it a lot easier when you're like, I'm it. And so my personal faith, a lot of times I'm like, God will take care of them. God will take care of it. I don't have all the answers. I don't have all the control. Some things are outside of my control. So I really need to trust in what I'm actually saying I believe in. Having alignment.
Yes. Alignment, because you do have to depend on faith, right? Especially when you say you have faith, but then you're still moving like you're in this alone. Mm-hmm. So to be able to tap into that faith, trust and believe, that's a big step. That's one thing that you would recommend, is leaning more on that faith.
Yeah, absolutely. I saw this recent clip and the woman was talking about too many Black women are dying from trying to be a mini Messiah. And it resonated with me because we're trying to save people, trying to rescue people. And it takes a toll on your physical health, your mental health, your emotional health. And so you're not going to really have nothing left for yourself or for the people that really do depend on you on a regular basis.
Yeah. And the thing I'm hearing is most people would probably say, what am I supposed to tell that person? How do I just cut off the help that I've been giving them without feeling like a bad person?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because you're going to feel the guilt. You're going to feel the shame. And it definitely takes some work around shifting how you view help and also how you help. You may not be able to help them in this exact way that they're asking, but maybe you can offer something else. Maybe you can point them to someone else and say, I don't know this information, but you can talk to this person or propose some other solutions. You don't have to necessarily always say yes to what they're asking, right? You can make some adjustments and identify for yourself, what are you okay with and what are you not okay with? I think that's really important for both men and women. If you're saying that you're not okay with something, and then you're acting in a different way, you're going to have some internal conflict, and that is going to take its toll. So if you're okay with something, make sure that's a genuine place where it's coming from, where you're really okay with it. But if you're not, you have to be honest with yourself and say, I'm not comfortable proceeding in this way. So really about getting to know your values, what's your priorities, what's important to you, how far are you willing to go with people?
Yeah, boundary setting.
Yeah.
Set good boundaries for yourself.
Yeah.
We hear it. You can't be good for yourself if you're stretching yourself too thin, but it's like self takes the back burner.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. When we're stressed out, we tend to take out the things that are actually going to help us during that stressful time. Mm. People get in stressful situations, they will start removing healthy eating. They will stop getting to sleep at a certain time, right? We start to take out the things that actually are going to give us some resiliency during this stressful time. It's something that organically happens to all of us. So we have to be careful of that, because that is what's going to add to having that difficulty getting through that situation.
Yeah. So for you, because you became a therapist to help people understand their emotions and experiences and how to find better coping skills, I'm curious about what led you into that direction.
Yeah. So my own experiences having a chronic condition that ended up influencing my mental health. And it also became the thing that I realized now that my autoimmune conditions was very much connected to how I was moving in life, worrying, anxiety, things like that. It took its toll and I just didn't have that awareness. I was about a teenager. So I was very young when all of that happened. So boom, there's an introduction to the mental health field. And God led me right back to the field. When I got into college, they were like, what do you like to do? Because I wasn't sure what my major was going to change to at that point. I was trying to do computer science and it just wasn't working. So I talked with them and got connected to nonprofit world and then went into social work school and became a therapist. But really being inspired to know why we do the things that we do. I've always been curious about that. I've always been a person that people came to for help or advice or talking about their emotional stuff, especially heavy stuff. Why are you choosing me? Why are you telling you this stuff? It was people I knew, but it was also strangers. And I just found that to be always something that was a constant in my life. So naturally, being a therapist, I just came into it because people always said, you're a good listener. You've helped me out a lot. They would say that I helped them. And being able to encourage and empathetic. So those types of qualities made it a really great fit to be a therapist. I had to really learn about doing that self-care because that's one of the professions where it's really difficult to engage in that self-care. Even though we all are educated on it, they talk to us at museum about it in social work school and in every webinar of these that we had, but still it was very hard to put into practice because you want to do right by your clients and you want to take care of so many people. So it's definitely been a journey of learning how to actually do self-care in a way that is not surface and cookie cutter based off of kind of what is presented. A lot of times we know these things, but we don't have the clarity and you don't have the pathway to do these things, so then we stay stuck.
The clarity or the pathway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So with your autoimmune disorder, you mentioned that kind of sparked the thought. Somehow it connected to therapy. So because that's a medical condition first, but you didn't say, I want to go into the medical field. You did. So you learned somehow. So I'm wondering, you learned then that your lifestyle or the way you were coping with things was connected to that diagnosis?
Yeah, I think it was definitely a wake-up call. It brought attention things to the surface for me, but also for my parents. I was always a achieved young individual, straight A's and B's. I typically was quiet, mild-tempered. So really, there was no reason to be concerned about me because of how I appeared. But when I look back, there were just things that I'm like, people weren't expressing those same worries or fears that I were, and that they had different ways of thinking. And so I just was like, okay, that's just odd, and would put it to the side. But once that situation happened, my parents were something's off. And then I just reacted to this big adjustment because my life changed drastically during that time. I went from an average teenager to being in Johns Hopkins Hospital for 2 weeks, having to take a bunch of medicine, having to talk to a bunch of doctors. So just naturally, anybody would have a hard time coping with that kind of drastic change in your life. So that was what led to therapy, is you're going through a lot of changes. Why don't you go talk to someone? And the doctor said it so matter-of-factly. And so it was the first time I had ever heard of, hey, go to therapy, because prior to that, it was the notion, this is for white people, right? White people have the resources and the time and the funds to sit down and talk about their life. And so I had these very stigmatizing views of therapy. So once I actually got into therapy, it was like, oh, this is way different than what everybody has described and what I've seen on TV. And the notion that this was something that was helpful for me, I was like, how many other Black people would this be helpful for, who feel like they have to keep things inside because they don't have anyone to share it with? So that has kind of inspired me to learn more about the field and to have a much more appreciation for it, because I did have that positive experience with that first therapist.
Yeah, you did. And you, it changed everything.
Yeah.
So with that, with the diagnosis, before all of this, you mentioned one thing. You said you realized that you thought differently than other people. Absolutely. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, I felt things deeply. Things affected me for a lot longer than they seemed to affect other people. I was sensitive to what people would say, what people would do. My feelings were hurt easily. I was a quiet, shy child. And so there was a lot of conversation around, we need to speak up, we need to be louder, be an ordinary kid, get in trouble, do something. So there was pressure already, this negative connotation that you're quiet, you're shy, something's wrong with you, you need to talk, right? And adults trying to force that out of me versus letting it organically happen or getting to know me. So that caused me to shut down a lot and go internal. And so we know when we go internal, we're not then having the conversations and talking about things that bother us. My family was really great, really supportive, but I did grow up in church, and you know, my parents were really well respected in the church. So people had this idea about me and my sisters that very much you have to live up to the standard. So that developed into perfectionism, and that developed into, I can't let people down. I can't be like everyone else, because people had such a high expectation for me and my sisters, right? Developed into this, I have to be on all the time. I call it the habit altogether mask, right? I started to learn how to put on that mask and pretend that I was okay and fine and great, even when I wasn't. And so then you start to just stuff in, but to suppress it, you just don't talk about certain things, and you just go about your life, right? Until you can't pretend anymore. And that's what happened. I couldn't, at a certain point, I couldn't pretend. And so when I got sick, it all exploded. It was like I couldn't pretend anymore, that certain things weren't bothering me, or that certain things weren't festering.
Yeah. And how much support did you receive from family after that?
Yeah, my parents were really supportive. My sisters were supportive. But they were also, my sisters were living their own lives. They were older. So they were getting to the point of wanting to get married and transition out of the home and have families. And there was only so much. I was the youngest. My older sisters, 6 years older than me, and then I have another one that's 8 years older than me. So I was on the back end. That definitely played in the dynamic. They tried as best as they could to be there for me, but I still always felt like the peacemaker and in the family to some degree. I still felt like I had to show up in a way that helpful, and just not wanting to be a problem, sometimes just not wanting to be noticed. But yeah, my family didn't reinforce a lot of it. It was a lot of the outside that was reinforcing those things. Like I said, you just start to try to find where you fit in. And where I could fit in was helping people. It made me feel valuable. It made me feel useful. So naturally, I wanted to continue to exist in those spaces.
Helping is one thing, because one thing I'm noticing with you is that you are a helper. You are naturally that way. You feel things differently, people. You resonate with their experiences naturally. So let's say you're really being super strong too, because you have to be so strong to help others in that way, to be that space. So my thing is, in some sense, are you saying that it's okay to be a helper, but you have to find where that helping works best and find the balance? Because what if they're like, I just love doing it, I can't stop?
Yeah. I encourage people to find that happy medium. And how do you consider both other people and yourself at the same time? Like, how do you keep that coexisting? Oftentimes, we feel like we have to choose one or the other. And I found myself being in that space where, okay, I'm choosing people. But I also needed to think about myself and choose myself and say, hey, what can I do in this situation? Is there anything that's too much for me? How do I do this in a way that is also healthy for me? And it's possible. It's a way of helping with boundaries in place. And so that just means that you know what point you're no longer able to help, or at what point do I no longer have the capacity. One of the things they teach when you're a social worker is that if you do not have the credentials or the ability to support this person, you're not an expert, please refer them to someone else, because otherwise you could be doing a lot of damage. So it's that same kind of philosophy of sometimes we have to say, I don't have the capacity. I can't do this right now. I can't listen to you right now, but I can listen to you later. Being able to make those distinctions so that you can move in a way where if you are able to show up, by all means, show up. But if you can't, don't trick yourself into thinking that you can.
Yeah, and then not putting that expectation on yourself. And early on, like you said, especially in the church, I'm wondering how much that influenced your behavior, because we know in a church, this is, you need to be right. You need to learn what's right. And this is the place you're going to learn how to live that life. So when your family is so invested in it and you're going to church every Sunday, every Wednesday or whatever, that's to some extent making it worse, that pressure to perform perfectly.
Yeah, it can. It was the unfair expectations, right? And people having us on a pedestal when we never asked for that, because they did esteem our parents. And I'm not saying anything with my parents' fault, because they were just being, they were just serving. They were just being themselves, and seeing them do what they did, I really respected it. My dad was like a deacon. He became a trustee. Then he became a minister. So he did a lot, but he taught me a lot as well, a lot of great things in watching him. And then my mom would always be cooking somewhere in the church. But people had such a this idea that we were had to be the good girls, I would say. I had to put it in words. Those are the good girls. And then they would be like, those are the wall girls, putting our last name out there. So there was a connotation. You had to live up to that name. It was a lot of pressure.
Yeah, it was a lot. And I'm just thinking about me growing up in the church too. I didn't have the mom cooking and the dad deacon. My grandparents and stuff, they were there. I was in the choir and stuff. And I'm seeing and thinking of all of the other families whose families were more invested like your own. And no one's thinking about that then. No one's thinking about the pressure on these children at that time. And I think it's an important piece to consider it, that every child needs space to be a child, to make mistakes, to be imperfect. And like we're saying, we're not saying anything about the parents. They're just praising the Lord and trying to live their best life. Right. But we are saying that sometimes that can be harmful.
Absolutely. Because you don't think that you can make mistakes, or you become very scared to make, or people take your small mistakes and amplify them, whereas someone else's child made a bigger mistake and then they have all the grace and compassion for them. That used to really upset me when I was younger. It's like, this person did way worse and you're giving them grace, and but then you're hard on me because of who my parents are, because of who I am or who you see me as. So yeah, it can be very harmful.
Mm-hmm. On top of the already ingrained in our souls to be strong anyway, because we have to be. We don't have help out there is what we generally think in the Black community.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But yeah, we don't have it. It's not for us.
Nope. And you had to think about it. All of us as young Black kids, you're taught you have to do more than the average person. And it's true, right? You have to work 10 times harder than everyone else in order to succeed or to even maybe get the same opportunities that somebody that's putting minimal effort but has the right complexion is doing. So you learn that, okay, I have to go hard each and every time. But what does that do to us in the process?
Yeah, and we end up not being able to go at all sometimes.
Exactly.
But our, yeah, we're human. That's it. That's at the core. That's all we are. We're humans. We experience the same emotions in different ways, but we have to figure out how to handle ours better.
Yeah.
And where would you recommend, especially people of color and women who are carrying so much on their shoulders, where should they start with letting go of this harmful thought and the patterns?
First, you got to know what's there. Have the awareness and recognition. And to also really think about the cost. If I continue to go in this way, am I going to be like so many other women that have high blood pressure issues or different people that even Black men, right? Heart attacks, right? Heart disease, cardiovascular disease, all of those things are common. Suicide is a thing that I'm hearing about a lot of young people, especially a lot of Black people. Is that worth the cost that I'm going to run myself so to the point that I'm like, I don't want to be here anymore? But just thinking about all the other diseases that, you know, derive from stress and really take its toll, right? Being unhappy, being, am I okay with that? This is going to cause resentment and that this could potentially lead to bitterness, right? That this could lead to me not wanting to help anyone at all, right? Sometimes it takes out the joy of helping, right? It takes out the joy of being here for people. You lose that because you're being taken advantage of. So you really have to think about the cost of these things. It is taking us out earlier and earlier. And so to have a life beyond just the grind.
The grind mentality.
Yeah, the hustle. And then, like I said, that hyper independence, it just solidifies, right? You keep going. You just push through it. You can't stop, right? Everything's going to fall apart. The more that we tell ourselves those things, and it also keeps us isolated, right? It keeps us less united as a community. And we see a lot of division in the Black community. And that's a big part of it, right? And everybody feels like they got to be their own individual. Now I'm going to get mine, get yours. That mentality just tears us down. None of us move forward, right? We all get stuck in a place. We really have to consider and have awareness that these things are here, even if we may not want to acknowledge it.
Yeah. So when you say that, because it's true, like you said, I get mine, you get yours, but we're not coming together. Yeah. We're not working together.
Yeah. And that's heal, but we need to heal collectively. It can't just be all individual healing, right? Some people are not going to want to join in with that, but find the people that are also trying to heal, right? Find people that are also looking for solutions, not just the people that want to just talk about the problem. Sometimes we can get so stuck on talking about the issue that we don't get to the solutions part, right? The solutions part is the thing that's going to build us and help us progress. And this is a time where I really see community is really important. It's going to be really important. We don't know what's going to happen in the next several years. And so we're going to need that sense of community back, right? Where we're helping each other, right? We're feeling each other. I always think of the scripture that talks about iron sharpens iron, right? So the way that we continue to help people, it's because other people come in and pour into me so that I can continue to be there for people, right? If you're helping and there's nothing pouring into you, you're not going to be able to help at a certain point.
Yeah. Because you have two options. If there's not someone pouring into you, then you would have to think then they're taking from
you. You'll either be just recycling energy that you have, and so you're not going to be able to do energy for things like yourself. You're going to take away from that energy reserve, or you're just going to be able to get to a point where you shut down and you can't do anything. Usually, that's what happens when people get sick. Like I've been dealing with people all these years.
Yeah. I think it's so important to really take in, because you hear it, we hear it, that your mind and your body, they're connected, and that you can literally make yourself sick. But I don't think people take that in. And there's so much truth to that. You can develop a chronic illness or disease from your mental thoughts, your patterns, the way you treat your brain, basically. Mm-hmm. The way you're ignoring thoughts that you know are unhealthy for you, but you push them away. You continue on the same path, just digging a deeper hole, and you can get sick and die. Yeah. Let's be honest.
Yeah. There's a lot that can be at stake. And most people will think that won't happen to you, right? That are probably listening and they're like, that's not going to happen to me. We don't think that is going to apply to our situation. But sometimes we do need that wake-up call. I definitely remember times in the past when I had to really stop and say, hey, if you keep going this way, you're going to be really in a bad place. You can't keep going like this. You have to change something. And that's important to have that moment where you say, I can't keep going like this.
Yeah, and of course, we would hope that we could make those decisions before we get to that moment, but it's still okay to still recognize in that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So as an adult, do you see children too? Do you see youth, adolescents?
I don't anymore. I used to, but since I had segued into just adults, so a lot of my clientele tends to have depression, anxiety, and some co-occurring disorders, so maybe like ADHD, bipolar disorder, things like that. In terms of the spiritual coaching, like I said, what I really do is just work with Black women and moving that all together, have it all together mask. We work on removing that and really getting spiritually grounded so that you can have a wholeness, so that you can have this sense of peace, and so that you can let go. So you don't have to put your hands in everything. We have Black women, I noticed, we try to control a lot, right? And I have to check myself on it. I have to say, Ashley, stop. You're trying to control everything. And I see it also in the people I work with. You can't control that. Take your hands off of it. So that's what we really do, is like we're surrendering this to God. And there's a peace that comes out of that. I can't even explain how valuable that is. You just feel the shift. You feel the change. And so making that space for us to experience that, because there's a lot more spaces for other groups of people and not necessarily those same spaces for us. And the other thing that we do as well is we heal the hidden, right? Because there are things that we bury inside that we don't say. We don't want to admit that I can't handle all of this, or that, hey, I don't have it, right? I don't got this, because that involves vulnerability. And so a lot of times we'll say, I'm fine. So it's a lot to admit, hey, I'm not fine, and to have a safe space to do it. Because most of the time in the Black community, you don't have the safe space to do that, men or women, right? Somebody can weaponize that against you, or you'll be seen as weak. So you just keep it hidden.
So you do a lot of work on uncovering that hidden stuff, making them, you guys, comfortable with saying it all out.
Yeah. And then shifting and changing how you are taking on responsibility and saying, God, that's in your hands. I can't sit here and worry about that. I can't sit here and try to problem solve for everyone. I can't put my hands in everything. I'm surrendering it to you. And it feels much lighter. He tells us, take my yoke. There's a reason that statement is there. It's lighter. Give your burdens to me. I'll take care of it. So we have to release and let go.
And you have to trust it, because people say it like, I'm giving that to God. But then there they are trying to fix it or work on it before they know it. So I think that accountability within groups, that's an important part of it, is to have like-minded individuals working through and on the same things you're working on, because you can find yourself slowly just going right back into that pattern. You're like, I'm going to give it to God, but then something comes up before you know it, you're back in help mode.
Yeah. I always describe it as I bring my stuff in a bag and I say, here, God, take it. And then after I'm done talking to him, I pick it right back up and leave. Because that's essentially what happens, right? Is that we put it down, but we don't put it down for long. We just pick it right back up after we finish talking to God, after we're done praying, after we left church, right? After we, you know, the thing, right? The devotional. You pick your stuff back up and then you're carrying it around. But then also you're carrying around the baggage of other people. So, and then you're carrying other people's stuff. You are carrying a lot of weight. And most people are carrying other people's baggage. And you have down their stuff as well as your stuff. It's hard. It helps to have guidance during those types of situations because it is challenging. And because the tendency is to pick it back up, especially if you are that go-to person that everybody depends on, that everyone goes to. You're going to want to pick it up. You learned how
to do it. So it, like with everything, it takes devotion and time to get to the point where you're naturally setting boundaries and thinking about yourself more and being able to say no.
Yeah.
To things.
Yeah. 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 To say no, or to say, I can do something different. I can't help in this exact way, but I can help in that way. So it gives a flexibility to helping and responding so that you don't feel pigeonholed into people pleasing. That's the thing, right? Yes, we are to be mindful of other people. In order to keep being in the position to do that, you have to be mindful of yourself. And like we said, we hear about these things all the time, right? Society. But I do notice that the pathways and the solutions are oftentimes not following in the conversations. The program is called Unmask, Heal, Rise. And so, you know, what we're trying to do is shift that of, hey, we know what the issue is. Yes, let's highlight it. Yes, let's put a light on it. But let's also get to some solutions. Let's do some transformation. Let's recognize we can live a little bit differently. It doesn't mean your problems are any different, but the way you approach them is going to be different. It's going to be different. The way you live is going to start to be different. And then that guilt and that shame is going to slowly subside because you're learning some things that are going to heal you.
Unmask, heal, rise.
Yes.
And is this virtual or is it in person only?
So this is virtual, and there's two options to do it. There is the group side, and then there is one-on-one time. And I am actually planning a workshop called Overcoming the Strong Black Women Phenomenon, where I talk more about the narrative and the historical context of this strong Black woman stereotype, but how to navigate away from that. In terms of your own mindset and how you're seeing yourself, right? People can still think it, but if you agree with it, if you take on the narrative, that's going to impact how you think. So it's really, people may think it, but we're not going to think it. We're not going to keep perpetuating it within ourselves. I'm not going to perpetuate it with my future children. I'm not going to perpetuate it with my nieces and things like that. Being mindful of, what are we wanting to pass on to the next generation? Do we want to pass on what we've been told is just, I'm tired. Oh, yeah, me too. All right, I'll talk to you later. You want to keep having those conversations? Do we want our future generations to have those conversations, or do we want to leave them with something different?
Yeah. Yeah, be the change.
Yeah, be the change.
Right.
Just finalize the date.
All right. And is this... So is this specific to your area or is it
worldwide? You know, just like I said, opening up the conversation for this is what where we're at. This is where we want to be. And like I said, if you work through those trauma responses, that is really just going to uplift Black women as a whole. This is going to help all of us because We see this in multiple countries and different backgrounds, that just being a woman of color and being a Black woman, there's still that expectation to appear strong. Yeah, it's that, you know, stop crying, cry in front of anyone. Messages that we get to keep things in.
Yeah. And it also keeps us down. So Ashley, you said some great stuff, and I want to give you the opportunity to give one final wrap up, something important that you just want the audience to know.
Yeah, we don't have to keep living certain ways and certain lives, but we can make these shifts. I think it's really important. We can still be there for people, but we have to learn how to do that in a way that is both healthy and sustainable. Right now, we don't have as many healthy and sustainable ways to do that. And so the community suffers.
I want to thank you for your time today. It's been amazing. And I want to encourage you to keep doing great work.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this conversation and being here. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Have a great day.
Yeah.